growing up, the journalist Olga Kazan felt like an outsider. She was from a family of Russian Jewish immigrants and atheists, besides, living in West Texas. So she had always paid attention to those who didn't fit in. In fact, she's written a book about it, where she tries to explain what it means to be weird. It's actually the title of the book, and how to embrace it. She talked to a transgender mayor in Texas, a woman NASCAR driver, a liberal in a conservative community, a conservative in a liberal community. Oh, and a Mormon missionary named Alex.
He grew up Mormon, and when he was in college, like a lot of other Mormons, he was ready and set to go on a Mormon mission. And they decided to send him to Sofia, Bulgaria. So he gets there, and it suddenly dawns on him that the Bulgarians that he's reaching out to are not very excited to become Mormons. So he's waking up early every day, knocking on doors, walking around the streets and saying, I'd like to share a short message about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And people are not very open to this message. You know, people slam the doors in their face and in his companions. They say, like, nay, I'm not interested. So he gets this, like, very clear sense of, like, I don't belong here. And this place is kind of out to get me. Do I really want this bad enough to continue to, like, try to push and try to bring my beliefs and kind of try to get others to buy into my beliefs? Do I really believe my beliefs enough in order to do this really arduous task? He really felt like he couldn't quit the mission. So he's like, I'm gonna just fill up my time in other ways. So he decides to learn to play Clair de Lune on the piano. And he, like, practices other languages. And it kind of leads to this sense of questioning in him. He started kind of pulling away from the church. And ultimately, he left the church. Because he realized that even though he was surrounded by Bulgarians who didn't like his message, that honestly, he didn't ultimately like his message that much either. Quitting the Mormon church kind of showed him, like, okay, it's okay to know when something is just not working for you and you need to find another way.
Being in a group made Alex dedicated to basically getting out. But there's another Mormon missionary you talked to. And being in the group made this missionary even more dedicated to staying in. What's the difference between Alex and the other missionary, do you think?
The other missionary was named Taylor. And he also was kind of the odd man out. He was in the Czech Republic, which bills itself as, I think, the most atheistic country on the planet. And he had a really different metaphor for the church and its missions. He said that it's like walking through a rose garden. You can feel the thorns, but when you look back, all you see is the roses. You know, whenever everyone's constantly questioning you and your beliefs, you have to really commit to them or not, or commit to not having them anymore. It just shows the fact that people who are different from everyone else around them, like if they're a Mormon missionary in a atheistic country, are going to feel really scrutinized and often uncomfortable, and that it's going to make you decide what you really believe.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Olga Kazan is joining us today. Her new book is Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. Kazan is a staff writer for The Atlantic. She's also worked for the Los Angeles Times and the Washington Post. And while her book is a social and scientific exploration of conformity and ostracism, it's also kind of a memoir. Throughout her life, she often felt weird, a Russian Jewish family in deeply Christian and deeply conservative Midland, Texas. In fact, here's the perfect way she describes that culture clash she encountered when she was a kid. She says her babysitter saw speaking in tongues as a fun afternoon activity.
Yeah, I mean, so it was like a very different place than I live right now in kind of the outskirts of D.C., but it was really, really dissimilar to the East Coast. Almost everyone was an evangelical Christian. My parents are not. They're not any kind of Christian. There were no other Russian immigrants. It was just a really, really unusual experience. So I felt like a lot of the things that the rest of the town took for granted, the way that, you know, they kind of the things they just understood to be true without questioning were just not things that my family believed at all. And a lot of their traditions and ways of being and rituals and customs were not things that my family practiced. So it definitely made it weird to be a child, because you constantly feel like not just that you don't belong, but kind of like you're learning two cultures at once, which is like kind of a unusual experience for a child.
So you felt weird in Midland growing up, and then your family moves to the outskirts of Dallas. You felt weird there.
Yes.
How did you feel when you went to American University? That's a very different sort of environment.
So that was like a very, it's like, imagine if you like had a scar on your cheek or something, and you were going through your whole life and people kept talking about the scar on your cheek. And then suddenly you get to a place and like everyone has a scar on their cheek. Like, it's sort of like this thing that I thought was like my secret shame, or like this thing that made me so unusual, or that I had to overcome right away as soon as I met everyone, was just no longer an issue at all. Like, people, I mean, it, to the extent that being an immigrant got any attention in college, it was only positive attention, which was just the newest, most strange experience to me. And I completely had to remake my personality, because my entire personality at that point had been like explaining why I'm different.
Yeah.
So
I want to get to some, let's define our terms here, because I think people, and you acknowledge this in the book itself, of course, people are going to be put off by the word weird. Like, what is she talking about? What does she mean exactly by that? And you acknowledge that it's, to some anyway, offensive or negative. But one of the things you mention is you want to own it. You want to reclaim it, I think is how you put it.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people who have a different background or a different belief system or a different identity from whatever is the predominant one in their environment can feel like outsiders and feel like being different is a bad thing. But I guess one thing I'm hoping to do with this book is reclaim it as a positive thing. Like, think about all the things that your weird identity has given you and how it's made you stronger and possibly, you know, more gifted in other ways, rather than just like, it was so hard and I was so weird and it sucked.
Yeah. Another thing we should say, just to sort of get this out of the way, as you do in the book, is that you're not saying your experience as a white immigrant is the same as the obstacles of, for example, as you put it, people of color or those living with rare medical conditions. Like, that's not really the same thing. You want to say something about that?
Yeah. I didn't want to be have this kind of be construed as like, I'm saying that all struggles are the same, or that, you know, white immigrants have it as bad as African Americans. That's definitely not what I'm saying. Like, I think especially in recent months, we've seen how much more horrific some of the crimes against African Americans are than any white person, including white immigrants. So it's definitely not the same. This is more of a book about people who kind of feel this way no matter where they come from, rather than trying to compare the two or say that they're equivalent.
When did this occur to you? When did you start thinking, I want to say something, I want to write something about outsiders, about people who could be thought of as weird? When did this, have you been thinking about this a while? Is it reflected in your early writing, the things that you maybe are even unconsciously drawn to?
I mean, definitely when I was a kid, I was always drawn to, if there was a kid who had even something slightly different about them, I was very usually drawn to that person and like really wanted to befriend them just so I had this like better chance of being understood. And I think later in life, I got really interested in subcultures and people who were sort of heretics or change makers in various ways. Like I just got really, really interested in this process of like, I see what everyone else is doing and I'm going to do a completely different thing. And it, I think like subconsciously, like that resonated with me in different ways. Like I sort of felt like that's what I was doing for part of my life. I would say it's always sort of been there psychologically, but then I actually started covering psychology as part of my job 7 years ago. So I was really started looking into it then and saw that there was this huge psychological literature behind it.
In the book, you say weirdness affects us all in one way or another. What do you mean?
I think that there's just like a lot of people that I talk to often say that they feel like an outsider. Like I can't really explain why, and I don't know if they always can. Like I think this is like a universal experience. Like imposter syndrome is just one example. Is so common among women. So many women feel like I don't belong here. You know, I feel like, you know, everyone else knows something that I don't know. I really think that this is like more common than just people who literally were the only Mormon in Bulgaria or something like that.
Right. The imposter syndrome, say a little bit more about that, if you would. How do you understand how that works exactly? Because it does seem like one of those things that a lot of us struggle with, that at some point someone's going to burst onto the scene and discover that we're all, that, you know, we're a fraud.
It's just this idea that like, that everyone else, got the memo and I didn't, or that I don't fit in here and that it's going to take me longer. It's going to be harder for me to do this same work that everyone else is doing. And it's just super common, especially among women, among, people of different ethnic identities or races that aren't kind of the predominant one. It can start to feel like because you're not very well represented in the boardroom or in the leadership roles, that's because of something about you that makes you not qualified. Of course, that's not true, but a lot of people have these beliefs, and it can really hold you back and lead to a lot of like overwork and self-doubt.
Olga Kazan, she's a staff writer at The Atlantic. Her new book is Weird: The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Weekends are kind of a toss-up. Sometimes we're productive, and other times we're lazy. But no matter where you are on the scale of busyness, KUER is ready to spend the day with you. On your smart speaker, just tell it to play KUER. And
wait, don't tell me the...
This is All Things Considered from NPR.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio.
Have a laugh, stay informed, and ultimately enjoy your weekend with NPR Utah. Tell your smart speaker to play KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Olga Kazan is with us to talk about the concept of being weird. That is, being an outsider in your community, in your school, in your life. A few years ago now, Kazan started interviewing people who were misfits like her, many of whom seemed to be handling it better than she was. And she wanted to figure out why some outsiders are just more comfortable in their own skin. The book is called Weird. Well, let's talk about some of the people you interviewed and got to know as you wrote the book. Let's start with Michael. Michael Ain is his name. Tell us about Michael.
He has dwarfism, so he is like about as tall as a 9-year-old. And he's like also a decorated surgeon at Johns Hopkins, which is like one of the best hospitals in America, obviously. And I just thought he was so impressive because, you know, maybe it's not that unusual now to have someone of short stature reach that kind of job. But he was, you know, coming up in this time when people were like saying the M word, like midget, like people were just wantonly discriminating against him, you know, medical schools were rejecting him because of his height. They were saying that that patients won't respect a doctor who's only, 4 foot something tall. They were saying like they want tall doctors with long white coats.
The incredibly patronizing bunch of nonsense he had to put up with throughout that time of his life.
Yeah, all because of his height. Like there's nothing about him other than, the only difference about him is his height. And so he applied to something like 40 medical schools and finally got into one, and gradually, like through this process of fighting uphill, became a professor of orthopedic surgery at Johns Hopkins and actually works on children of short stature. I just thought it was a remarkable story because I know a lot of us, after we get our, 39th rejection, are not going to be like, I'll try a 40th time. But he was really, persistent that way.
Well, one of the things that he does, and I'll clean this up just a little bit, but being an outsider is one of the things he does is he says F you to the naysayers. Like that's part of his character. Talk about that.
Yeah, he dropped a lot of F-bombs while we were talking. And I realized that's part of his thing. Like he is like this, this tough guy, I think from Long Island or something. And like, it totally comes through. Like if you tell him that he can't do something, he says F you and is going to do it anyway. And I think that really serves him well. And I was just so curious how to like unlock that attitude if you're not, don't happen to be him.
Well, what did you learn about that? Because I do think that's really one of the really important elements of this. And that is how can you, as you put this in the book, how can you get someone to cultivate an attitude like Michael's, where you just at least don't seem to care what other people think? Because that why it is we do care about what other people think is something embedded deep in human nature.
One thing that I found that a lot of my interviewees did that I thought was, especially in situations like this, where they felt like they had to prove that they belonged, or everyone else sort of, was trying to say that they had something that they won't, is kind of this kind of reframing of the situation to kind of tell themselves a better story about what's happening. I'm not saying that this is easy to do. I find this actually really difficult. But what they would do is sort of like tell themselves a better story about whatever's going on. So one kid that I talked to, not a kid anymore, but he was a kid when this happened to him. This guy, Ayinde, who was like this poor kind of a low income middle schooler growing up in New York. His parents were immigrants from Trinidad. And he got into this ritzy prep school, and he gets there, and it's about how you would expect. It's really difficult to make friends. Most people are like going to the Hamptons for vacation. They're even just like eating out after school. That's something that's really difficult for him to afford. He essentially just like starts to tell himself a better story about what's happening to him. Like, instead of saying like, oh no, I didn't go to camp. Yeah, I missed out. Like he'll say, oh, well, I got to spend all this time with my parents and that was really great. Like it's a time for me to bond with them that I won't get later. And like, granted, not everyone is like going to be good at this, but I thought it was like really cool how he was able to like tell a better story about what was happening to him.
One of the big questions you get at is, where it is this suspicion of outsiders comes from, where prejudice comes from. Tell us about the work of Henri Teifel.
It's this researcher who was kind of an early psychologist. He did most of his work in kind of the early 1970s. And kind of the most incredible thing about him is that he had survived the Holocaust. So he was Jewish, but because he was sent to a POW camp instead of to a concentration camp, he essentially survived. And it seemed like he was sort of like obsessed or interested in this kind of twist of fate of like how we sort people into groups and how like seemingly small differences can make a difference in who we trust and who we like and who we don't trust. So he did a lot of interesting studies on kind of just breaking, you know, schoolboys up into groups labeled like X and Y. And, you know, lo and behold, like group X would soon start to favor one another far over group Y, even if they had no reason to. So even if it was like totally irrational for them to band together as a tribe, they would. And so essentially he was kind of one of the early fathers of this idea of social identity theory, that we feel like we want to belong to a group. We like other people in our group and we dislike other people outside of our group. Mm-hmm. So even though this was a while ago, a lot of his findings have unfortunately held up over time.
There's this question that he looked into, and it's whether prejudice is, as he put it, is in the minds of people or the guts of people. What he found is it's in both. But what does he mean by the distinction between those two, the mind and the gut?
It seems like he believed that prejudice was more about groupthink and not specific to one nationality or another. So he kind of believed that. So at the time, there was like this idea that like Germans were more likely to be prejudiced people because of like certain things about Germans. But instead, Teufel was kind of like pushing back against that and saying like, it's not anything specific to Germans. Like anyone is capable of doing this kind of thing, like as I show with my experiments. But what I kind of use that quote to show in the book is that it's actually both. Like we both like consciously prefer people in our own group, and we also subconsciously we have like instincts in our brains that we're not really aware of that cause us to prefer people within our group than those outside of it.
One of the things that I have to say it surprised me, you often hear these days people trying to explain how it is that we became so divided as a country right now in our different, you know, political affiliations, is that it's just baked into us that we have these tribal inclinations. We're suspicious of outsiders. It's a sort of a biological feature that we have to really work hard to work through. And some of that's probably true to some degree. I mean, you write a little bit about that. But I want to talk about the research that you write about hunters and gatherers, and in particular the Shiwiar people of eastern Ecuador and northeastern Peru, because they give you a different sense of how we did and didn't get along.
So researchers study groups like the Shiwiar, who are these, you're right, like this hunter-gatherer population, to see how did we treat other people kind of before we turned into Democrats and Republicans and East Coasters and West Coasters and, you know, whatever other tribal groups we might have. And essentially there's a question in science, like we don't totally know whether we were kind of xenophobic or not in our ancestral past. So some researchers think that that nomadic foragers, as they're called, were kind of like hippy-dippy and really cool with one another and would travel with different groups of people and weren't very tribal. And they would kind of like trade with and interact with groups that lived hundreds of miles away. You know, others kind of paint a less rosy picture of that. But it's kind of agreed upon that when we started farming is when people became a lot more xenophobic and a lot less trusting of outsiders, because you had to move away from kind of like, oh, anyone can pick these berries and like, it'll be, you know, totally fine. There'll be plenty for everyone, to like, this is my patch of land and I've tended it for quite some time. And, you know, you can't just come and like pick my corn or whatever. So that was sort of the turning point is when we started farming. That's when you start to see things like war and religion and things like that, that kind of tended to divide people up.
Do you think it's structures, at least, is that a theory that's these institutionalized, organized structures that have been a kind of exacerbating force about all of this? Because you say there's some argument that warfare has actually increased since civilization took hold.
I do think structures played a big role in that. Like, you know, religion, money, rulers, they all divided people up into subgroups. And like, once you have subgroups, you have competition over resources. And you start to see that like later on in human history. You know, I write about kind of the sometimes very small differences between Irish Catholics and Irish Protestants, mm-hmm. who were of course at war for many decades and were at each other's throats. But sometimes it came down to, like one thing I write about was the letter H. Yeah. Protestants pronounced it H and Catholics pronounced it H.
Yep.
And people were literally like would freak out over this difference.
Because it was a tell.
Yeah.
It gave you away.
Yeah. But it's literally like a breath of difference. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's so minor, but unfortunately history is filled with these kinds of really, really atrocious and also scary xenophobic prejudices against people who are not that different from us.
Yeah. I want to ask you about Emma. Before we get there, talk a little bit about the Amish girls you discovered in American Girl magazine. It's another part that gets to the memoir part, which I really like. And these are often the ways into some of these other stories was your own sense of some of these girls that you encountered or people that you encountered. And you've got to say something about your finding an Amish girl at least a story in American Girl magazine.
Yeah. So at one point, a family friend got me a subscription to American Girl magazine, which was this great magazine for little girls. And so I start reading it and I was just so interested in it because it was like exactly what I wanted, which was other stories of other girls that I could relate to. And one of them was about Amish girls. And this one in particular, I was just obsessed with. It was so fascinating to me. I was so just wrapped in the fact that, you know, there were other girls out there who felt different and had to live this different life. And of course, being Amish was different from being Russian, but I just really got into it. So when I was researching this, I really wanted to talk to someone who would escape the Amish because that kind of launched a mini obsession into the Amish for me. And I kind of learned a lot about the society and I was like, really, I was really knowledgeable about it. And I was like, wow, this is something where like, if you are Amish and you feel like you don't want to be Amish anymore, it is very, very difficult to get out. It is very difficult to be a weird Amish person. And Emma, this woman who I interviewed, was just such a clear and interesting example of that. Like she, her whole life basically just was not bought into the Amish idea. You know, she didn't really want to live this life of farming and child rearing and taking care of a home. She wanted to have a career. She wanted to become educated, which women didn't really do in the Amish. And she decided to escape, even though her whole world and all she ever knew and everyone she knew had this same way of thinking and being other than her. Mm.
Tell about January of 2006, because this was like this monumental moment she goes through.
She had been kind of chafing at the Amish for a while and really was like wondering what to do. And finally she, that day she like takes off her bonnet, ties a scarf around her hair and just walks out of the farmhouse and calls a family friend who comes in and picks her up. And she leaves a note for her parents saying that she needs to try a different life and that she doesn't want to be Amish anymore. And that was sort of the last day that she was Amish.
I want to ask you about, there's so many different stories here, but let's talk about Jess Herbst.
Yeah.
First openly transgender mayor in Texas. Was it the Texas part that interested you because you were from there?
Yeah. So New Hope is like 30 minutes from where I went to high school in McKinney. So I was like, her story made national news. And when it did, I was so, I was just so intrigued by the fact that there would be a transgender mayor in that part of the country. I mean, it was so, we didn't even have an openly gay kid in my high school when I was there. So it was the fact that there would be an openly transgender leader was just fascinating to me. And it was wonderful to meet Jess. I mean, she the way she portrays it is that she did not have a very difficult time, you know, getting people to accept her in that area, that people were fairly accepting. She was able to find a community in Dallas of other transgender women to kind of draw on for support. But at the same time, she did lose her election. And she thinks that the reason she lost is that a lot of the, or her competitor, who's the current mayor, basically kind of canvassed the town saying, look at Jess, isn't that strange? Are you sure you want someone who's transgender to be the mayor? And so it kind of shows the limits of this kind of tolerance, where people might be willing to be nice to your face, but then when it comes down to it, they're not necessarily open to someone who seems so different.
Mm. There was this question you asked Jess, which I thought was really interesting. And the response was interesting too. And you say you'd been suppressing this for a while, this question. And it was simple of Jess, like, why not just move? Like, just go somewhere else. You're in Texas. You could go to the Bay Area. They'll think differently of you, at least in most cases. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, that was like toward the end of our interview, and she had described all these struggles she had been with and how long it had taken her to come out and how long it had taken her to transition. And I think she said something like, things just had to work out the way that they did, I guess. And I thought, first of all, that was like a very Texan thing to say. Like, it was very like, well, I'm just going to move on given the way things are. But it's also, you know, she clearly has an affinity for Texas and an affinity for her neighbors and, you know, had really lived her whole life there. So, It was definitely more of a case for staying where you are and trying to change the norms of the immediate environment rather than just fleeing to a place where you won't be considered weird anymore.
Yeah. She wanted to make the community better. And so she doesn't mind she gets a ton of tone deaf, clumsy questions all the time, you say, but she just sort of abides them because I think she wants to educate people, it seems, from all of that. I think the other thing that's interesting is you write about how a gender transition is not always, as you say, a smooth flip between identities, that there are still elements to the lives of some transgendered people that they don't have to contend with, that, you know, others don't have to contend with. Talk a little bit about that, because I thought that was really interesting this is complicated too, I guess.
So in Jess's case, like, I'm not defending the people who do this, but she really puts up with a lot. Like, I'm not defending the people who come to her with questions like these, but people will ask her, like, if she, you know, about her genitalia. People will ask her just different stuff that we would think is, like, too intrusive. But she does put up with it. I think she described herself as like the map of the mall where you can find Sears if you're lost, where she's like, you know, the directory for transgender people. And I kind of get that. I do feel like really bad for her that she has to put up with all that. And I don't think everyone would be ready to do that. And I talked to one other transgender person for this, Vivian Ming, who described having a lot of mental health issues before she transitioned. After she transitioned, definitely things got better for her in a lot of ways, and she obviously felt more self-actualized and happier, but she still struggled with a lot of anxiety and a lot of stress and especially social anxiety. She gave a lot of speeches that described like always wanting to like kind of retreat back to her room as quickly as possible. So I think in some ways, like, you know, it obviously like people should be able to transition if they want, but they still struggled with things that other people don't have to put up with.
I was surprised that there's a section in the book, a story of Asma, I guess is her name, born a devout Muslim African immigrant family. And this question of cleanliness and disgust you talk about in this section here. And it really got me thinking about the moment we're in right now with this pandemic and how, you know, how COVID is going to change the way we look at each other, whether we'll be inclined to create more outsiders or we'll be more suspicious or more drawn together. Talk a little bit about Asma first, And then a little bit about this part, this idea how pathogens and fear of getting sick makes us less open to outsiders.
So Asma is a pseudonym for a woman who grew up in a small conservative Christian town in the South. And she was a Black Muslim. And it was difficult. I mean, you know, people constantly asked her why she doesn't eat pork or why she doesn't worship Jesus or other questions like that. You know, after 9/11 was an especially difficult time. People had a lot of suspicions of her. And one reason why we have these kinds of suspicions of people who are different is something called the behavioral immune system, where it's sort of like this psychological impulse not to trust people who seem like they could be from somewhere else. So if someone seems like they have a different religion or a different ethnic background, we kind of have this impulse to be like, ooh, maybe I should stay away from them. And the reason for that is that we are afraid that they might, again, subconsciously, not in a rational way, that they might harbor diseases that we're not equipped to fight off. So the thinking is that if, you know, I'm back in the time before antibiotics, and someone comes into my village and they're doing, you know, they're dressed really strangely or they're acting really strangely, they might have a disease and they're going to wipe out my village because they're from somewhere else. So we still have this like leftover instinct to be kind of like, ooh, I don't know if I want to like welcome that person in because they're doing something kind of weird and I might get sick. And unfortunately, you do see that in today with people being really racist toward people who might be Asian or who look like they might be Asian. Because, you know, even if that person is not literally from Wuhan province in China, you still have this like subconscious feeling of like, ooh, I should be careful because COVID's going around and we, you know, China's where it originated. Hmm.
The last part of your book gets at the question of whether you should find your own kind, you know, go search them out because you're sick of being an outsider, or just remain the different one. Talk a little bit about the choice, first of all, because you write about this.
Part of the book, I was interested in people who kind of chose either route. So there are people who actually move to be with others like them. So, I mean, obviously you see this a lot in, you know, with liberal college students, like moving to New York or Los Angeles after they graduate in order to, you know, be in the mix of kind of like liberal artsy types. But the reverse is also true. I interviewed these people with this group called Conservative Move, which helps Californians move to Texas so they can be with other Republicans. So that's an example of people moving to be with their own kind, especially if that kind is conservative.
I liked this part of the book too, because it wasn't just liberals being surrounded by Texas conservatives. It was people in the case of a man by the name of Paul and Crystal.
Yeah, right.
They were in California. They were surrounded by liberals. They wanted to just one person talked about how he said he moved to Texas because he didn't want to change the place. He went there to be a Texan. Mm-hmm. And it made me wonder if there's a lesson there that for some outsiders, this is just exhausting trying to change everyone else around them or educate them. And sometimes you just want to, you know, you just want to be with others like you.
Yeah, I mean, I can kind of understand that. Like, yeah. I'm not like necessarily justifying their political beliefs, but yeah, like, so this couple that I talked to, Curtis and Crystal, they lived in Long Beach, California. But the in particular, the Curtis, the man of that partnership, really was a Trump supporter, and he really I think at one point he said something like, "It's like I couldn't walk around with my ideas." And that's because it's really hard to always be the one who's like, has the one, you know, is the one person in the group who doesn't have share the same political beliefs as everyone else. So when they saw McKinney, Texas, which is like this, you know, conservative bastion, they said, okay, let's jump at the chance and let's go there. And I thought that was, you know, that was interesting. Like they wanted to feel that comfortable embrace of like having everyone agree with you all the time.
Yeah. For the argument of staying, you know, remaining the different one. Let's go back to Dr. Ain, the surgeon with dwarfism that we were talking about earlier. He said something that's so interesting. He, as you said, he specialized in surgery on children of short stature, but he wouldn't do, in most cases, any limb lengthening, at least if the child's only issue or complaint was height. Like, he wanted them to what? Just accept who they were.
Yeah, and that really speaks to his own experience. He declined to have the limb lengthening done on himself when he was younger, and he's really, you know, even as he's so bombastic and says, like, F you to everyone, he's also, you know, really a defender of kind of accepting yourself the way you are, you know, being proud of who you are. And that to him includes not trying to modify your height in this, like, very honestly painful procedure that takes a really long time to heal. So I thought that was a good example of how some people, you know, even if they know that it's going to make them different, even if they know it's going to make them stand out, they're still willing to kind of stick by their identity and their beliefs and the way they are, because they know that, you know, they want to support other people like them.
But this also gets at something that you say, how this plays out differently in different countries. For little people, for example, in the U.S., little people tend to get together with their own kind. But you mentioned Spain in particular, for example. They prefer to integrate into a larger population. So, you know, do you go along with the crowd or do you teach people difference? Because you say that in your conversations, it became clear that many had been thinking about this, like, do you just not make a big deal of it? What did you learn about the way this plays out in other cultures and other countries?
Spain is the main other country that I looked at. Essentially, limb lengthening is much more popular. And the reason is that there, it's dwarfism is seen as more of like a condition to overcome. Like, all of the nonprofits and things are more geared toward you know, like, learning more about how to like treat dwarfism or like, you know, they have like interviews with medical specialists. But in the US, like, most of these groups are geared toward like how to fight off discrimination against you for being a little person. So it's kind of a different way of looking at being different, where in Spain it's a lot more accepted that you're gonna try to get taller and kind of blend into everyone else who's tall. Whereas in the US, it's like, you know, we're going to become a group of people who are proud of who we are and we're going to stick by each other. That's going to, you know, that's going to be better for your self-esteem, you know, as a little person, obviously. But it also might kind of, you know, draw additional stigma to, you know, the group. But in, you know, in the other version, you're going to maybe blend in a little bit better, but then you're kind of not really going to have a lot of self-esteem as a little person because you're kind of trying to fight that identity.
Yeah. Where is it better to be weird? Because that's one thing you get at is there are tight cultures and there are loose cultures.
Tight and loose cultures are just, I mean, they're almost exactly like what they sound like.
Yeah.
So tight culture is one where there's a ton of rules and one way to do everything, and people who don't follow the rules are punished. But loose cultures are kind of the opposite of that. They're cultures where kind of anything goes. There's a million ways to be. You're kind of free to be you and me. You know, think like, you know, San Francisco, like, hippie culture versus, you know, the Amish, for example, or someone said Burning Man, you know, versus, like, I don't know, the Mormons, you know, so it's easier to be weird in a loose culture because there aren't people telling you that there's like a certain kind of way to live, you know, and in a tight culture at the same time, it's easier to know kind of exactly what to do with your life because you're not kind of left with this, like, whatever you want, kind of like empty frame to fill.
Yeah. You say toward the end of the writing project for the book that you became, you became less sure about whether you and your family there in Texas really were outsiders. What do you mean by that?
I realized that my mom in particular had this totally different way of thinking about Midland than I had realized, which is that she felt like how much effort they put into helping us integrate into the culture and how like warm and friendly people there were really helped her overcome some of the outsider feelings or outsider status that she had when we lived there. Even though we were incontrovertibly different from everyone else, she felt like that kind of that feeling of like of warmth and welcoming really helped her feel more at home in Midland, even than she felt in Russia sometimes.
There's a great story you tell about this woman named Deanna and this conversation you had with her. You had a lot in common, you know, similar backgrounds. And you were having this conversation with her where she got really emotional. And then you got really emotional. And I think it connected to identity and family. Do you mind talking about that?
Deanna was this other Russian woman that I met when I was researching this book. And she had a much more difficult time than I did. So she came to the U.S. as a teen and also settled in a small Texas town. And she was actually the daughter of a mail order bride, which is a much harder thing to explain to people when you're kind of talking about your background and where you're from. So one kind of point of strength in her life and someone that she always turned to when things got tough was her grandma. Her grandma was extremely important to her, even in some ways more important than her, you know, actual mom and her immediate family. And her grandma had died not too long ago. So we were sitting there kind of like reminiscing and thinking about everything she's had to overcome and everything she's had to go through. You know, thinking about things that were important to her. And she started to cry because she really missed her grandma. And then I started to cry because I really missed my grandma. We had this moment of bonding and crying over our grandmas and thinking about, you know, what a big role they played in helping us feel loved and less weird. That was sort of it. Then we said goodbye.
Yeah. The book, one of the things you mentioned in the book is that part of what you were trying to do was look at the strategies you found in some of these people who are sort of trying to navigate their world as, you know, an outsider, to cure your own insecurities. You were looking to practice some of the strategies that you found. So what did you learn? Like what have you adapted into your life by talking with Jess and Emma and Michael and Alex and all of them?
One interesting strategy that I can try to quickly sum up is this one called idiosyncrasy credits, which is really hard to say, is like a totally unwieldy phrase. But essentially just means that in order to kind of spring your weird ideas on people, you first have to conform a little bit. So you first have to kind of agree with what, you know, the bosses are saying and kind of go along with everything and sort of nod and smile. And then you can kind of innovate and kind of spring your weird idea on folks. So it's kind of this two-step process. First, conform, then innovate. And that's kind of the best way to be a weirdo in a straight-laced society.
Are we, when we're in the political landscape we're in right now, does it make it easier or harder for weirdos?
I think it's harder because people are more, I think people are more polarized and they like people who agree with them on more things. So I think it would be harder to be someone who, say, agrees with the Democrats on, you know, 95% of things but disagrees with them on 5%, because that's going to get you a lot of flack on Twitter and elsewhere. Like, I think it's just really hard for people who don't have like lockstep beliefs about things. And it's just a hard moment for heretics.
Right. Olga Kazan, thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me on.
Olga Kazan, she's a staff writer at The Atlantic. Her book is called Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.